greetings. Welcome to The Dividing Line. My name is James White. Can't see anything on the screen again. I never know whether we're really started or not when that happens, but there we go. We'll get more advanced computer programs someday. Maybe a little red light. A little incandescent red light on top of the thing. Anyway, I don't know what made me go looking for this. But pulled this out of the dark corner of a storage place at home. This is a little Cambridge King James Version, red letter edition. I'm not real big into red letter, but it's got a little snap on it. And it's a little beat up on the corner down here, which would be an interesting illustration of some of the damage you see on the ancient papyri, but we won't go there right now. This was the primary Bible that I carried with me for many years out in Mesa at the Easter pageant and up in Salt Lake City. Honestly, as I sit here right now, I could not read it. I really couldn't. I've got a pair of reading glasses over there, and I might be able to pop them on, but I honestly could not read it. But when you look at what's marked in yellow, it's the key text that you use in talking to Mormons. And I don't think this is the one. I wonder where that one is. That might be in the other room. I think it was a gray one that I had the night that young Mormon missionary, it actually wasn't a missionary. It was a return missionary. Does that make you not a missionary? I don't know. Anyway, reached over my Bible and pointed at Ephesians 1:11 because I'm pretty certain I had it outlined. But it might have been this because it's in the right spot because I do remember that's where it was. So it might have been this one. I just thought I had it outlined. But that really wasn't a normal verse I'd be talking with Mormons about anyways. But I just read to that Mormon missionary, and I'm sorry. In whom also we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestinated according to the purpose of him who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will. I think I've told the story, but I'll tell it again. Was talking with this Mormon missionary. And he very, very quickly got to, you know, the real issue. And that was, he asked me, why are there so many different churches? And my response to him was, people pick and choose what they will not believe out of the Bible. And he obviously had not run into that particular response before. And so he said, well, you know, what do you mean? And so I, you know, went into it, and I basically was talking, you know, interestingly enough, the same thing that I said in the INC debate, sola scriptura and tota scriptura. You know, you have to believe scripture alone, but you also have to believe all of scripture. And as an illustration, well, he said, okay. And then we moved on to the issue of salvation. And he asked whether I believed in predestination. And I, you know, it might have been this one, because that's, I do remember that's exactly what it was on the page. So, but then again, if as long as the Ephesians started on that page, that's pretty much where it would be in almost any printing. But anyway, I read that, I opened Ephesians chapter 1 and I read that text. And he said, so you're saying, and I stopped him, and I reread it. In whom also we have obtained, you know, anymore I'd be in danger of assault, because I'd have to stick the Bible so far out. In whom also we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of him who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will. And he said, well, so you actually think, stopped him the third time, reread it. And he, you know, it was like holding like this. And he reached over and he tapped the page, found where the number was, tapped the page, says, "That's wrong, and I feel good saying that." And I've told that story a number of times before. Now, why do I start with that? Well, this is what I carried. And from this, I defended monotheism and fundamental Christian doctrine, sola scriptura, justification by faith. I dealt with how you know what truth is, the testimony of the Holy Spirit, all sorts of stuff like that. Out of this King James version of the Bible. So when I hear people saying, well, you're opposed to the King James or something like that, I always correct them. I'm opposed to King James onlyism because the translators of this Bible would have been opposed to King James onlyism. There's no question about that. None. So why then do I promote what are called modern translations? Well, because I do believe that as tremendous a monument to the scholarship of the early 17th century that this is, as deeply indebted as we are to the King James for so much of our language and terminology and how important it was, and I think everybody should have a King James and should be familiar with the King James, so on and so forth. The reality is it was done between 1604 and 1611. And I don't eat food from 1604 to 1611. I don't use the technology that existed between 1604 and 1611. I don't wear the clothing that was in existence between 1604 and 1611. And so I don't feel any particular requirement to have to use a translation into the English language that was produced between 1604 and 1611. Now, if someone applies the same methods of interpretation, hermeneutics, to this text as to my New American Standard or the ESV, are they going to come to a different conclusion on the key issues of the Christian faith? No, they're not. No, they're not. As much as there are King James only folks who would say otherwise, it simply isn't the case. But would I feel as confident going into a debate that would deal with the history of the text, the variant readings of the text, even the deity of Christ with the King James over against a modern translation? Well, of course, I wouldn't use a translation in those contexts anyways, but how about the underlying text? And this is sort of the underlying text for the New Testament. Actually, now that I think about it, I don't believe I own a 1525 Blomberg, which is the Hebrew basis of the... There's only like six or eight differences, so it's not a big deal, but probably have it in Accordance someplace, or if I don't, I'll need to get it. But this is sort of, ostensibly, the basis of the New Testament of the King James Version. Generally, this is called the Textus Receptus. That's somewhat of a misnomer. This actually only goes back to 1894. So what does that make? It's 123 years old. And it's not technically a real Greek New Testament. Though there, this day, there were many students, well, there were students in various places that were utilizing this as their primary Greek text in classes at relatively small Bible colleges. And they think that this is what was used in the King James. And in a sense it is, because this is the result of the work in by a man by the name of Scrivener. And what he did is he went back and he used the King James, the actual English translation. And what he did is he realized that the King James translators had a number of versions, printed versions, available to them. I showed you one last time. It's down there. That's the third edition, 1550 Stephanus. They had five editions of Erasmus, which he had produced between 1560 and 1535. They had the editions of Stephanus. The 1551 was the first one that had verse divisions, so they obviously had to be using some of those later ones for the verse divisions. And then they had a number of versions from Bayes, the most important of which was his 1598. So in almost no situations did they go outside of the printed text, either Greek or the 1525 Blomberg for the Old Testament, for any type of examination of the text or things like that. They did include textual footnotes, not very many of them, as was pointed out in one of the video responses to last week's program, but they did include them, which plainly shows they weren't saying, oh, this text that we've chosen is the text. You can't use anything else, and the church has spoken, and all the rest of that kind of stuff. Anyway, so what Scrivener did is, since they used different ones, and the New Testament was done by different committees. There was a Gospels committee and a Paul committee and General Epistles Revelation committee and stuff like that. So, unfortunately, there were inconsistencies between those committees. I've used the illustration that I learned about this, well, not the hard way, but a rather memorable way, I suppose. Years and years ago, dealt with an atheist by the name of Dennis McKenzie. And in an old, and this was when I first started subscribing to biblical errancy, not inerrancy, errancy. Why is Algo asking me questions in channel? Like I'm supposed to be able to type and talk at the same time? I have no idea. It's weird. When I first started subscribing to biblical errancy, it would come very clearly mimeographed. And many of you don't even know what mimeographed was. But a mimeograph machine was before the copy machine. And mimeographed paper had a special smell to it. Remember the smell to mimeographed paper? Oh, all the old people in the audience are going, hey, you triggered a memory of the brain cell there. That is cool. anyway, and Dennis McKenzie, one of the alleged errors in the Bible that he pointed to was the fact that the commandment, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not murder. In one place, in Matthew, in the King James, I think it's murder, and in Romans it's kill, or vice versa. I think it's vice versa. Anyway, and of course I pointed out to him, well, the underlying Greek's identical, so how can you say it's a contradiction when all it is the fact that the various committees, the King James, there really wasn't an overarching committee that sort of smoothed the translation out and made sure that each of those subcommittees had followed the same rules as to how they were rendering things. This also comes up, by the way, this comes up a lot with the cults, because Joseph Smith in Mormonism came up with three levels of heaven because of the translation committees of the King James. Did you know that? Why are there three levels of heaven in Mormonism? Because Joseph Smith looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and there is a glory of the sun, and a glory of the moon, and a glory of the stars. Then he says there's a celestial glory and a terrestrial glory. And Joseph Smith's looking at that, and he goes, oh, as a prophet, I see something's missing. Because there's three levels, sun, moon, and stars, and therefore celestial is the top, and terrestrial is the next. And so There must be something missing. And so he took the first two letters of terrestrial and slapped them on the last part of celestial and came up with a new word called telestial. And so in Mormonism today, you have the telestial level of glory. The problem is, the very same Greek words that are rendered celestial and terrestrial in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 are more accurately rendered as heavenly and earthly in John chapter 3. Joseph Smith, not being a prophet nor a student of Scripture, didn't know that, and so came up with something really weird. So anyway, those committees had, you know, one committee might might use Stephanus more often. Another committee might use Beza more often. Someone might use third edition of Erasmus more often. And there's differences between them. They're not major differences, but there are differences between them. And so what this is Scrivener goes, you know, let's produce a Greek text that reflects the textual choices of the King James Translation Committees. And so this is a Greek text based upon English translation, which was based upon numerous other Greek texts, which were based upon manuscripts. And that's where it comes from. And of course, there is no Greek manuscript in the world that reads identical to this. So when our friends say, well, you know, there's, you know, the reasoned eclecticism leads you to a text that no one's ever found in the manuscript. Well, I'm sorry, it's the same thing. It goes both ways. So, what's the point here? Well, last week, when I talked a little bit about textual critical things, I mentioned, you know, I held up my Stephanus text back there, and I pointed out that was the first printed Greek New Testament where variations were noted in the margins of the text itself, references to Greek manuscripts. Now, it was very few, obviously. And in comparison to what we have today, almost nothing at all. But the point was that it was a well-known reality that there were variations even in what we would today call the Byzantine manuscript tradition, which was the majority of manuscripts, is the majority of manuscripts. But here's the problem. I pointed out this is problematic for the ecclesiastical text position, which never wants to actually prove its assertions, but just simply assert them and hope that they're not actually asked to produce a text, because as they've pretty much admitted, they can't. The text that they have has been provided to them by other means. Erasmus didn't use their methodology. Stephanus didn't use their methodology. Beza didn't use their methodology. No one has ever used their methodology. Jerome didn't use their methodology to produce Vulgate. You cannot produce a text using their methodology because, as they say, well, it's not a methodology. It's a worldview. Well, congratulations. no one can produce a text with this belief system. And yet, we have a small number of people who are arguing that every major Reformed seminary is off the rails when it comes to having the proper Greek New Testament. And this ecclesiastical text movement is a retreat back into history so as to, in essence, produce what I would say is a false feeling of certainty rather than an advancement in helping more and more sound biblical believers to understand where we got the New Testament, why we have such an incredibly strong testimony to the New Testament, and how we can then defend that New Testament in regards to the attacks that are so prevalent upon it from people like Bart Ehrman and others. I don't know of any Reformed seminaries, any major Reformed seminaries, that utilize this methodology. I just don't. And in fact, when I have spoken to some of the leading scholars, and when I say leading scholars, I mean people who are publishing and are really taking the forefront of Christian theology, and especially in the area of the text of the New Testament, things like that. When I've spoken to them, they're looking at me like, there are people pushing that? Reformed people? And I'm like, yeah, I better keep an eye out, because they're, you know, yeah, they tend to be somewhat subversive in how they do it, but yeah, they're out there. And so I made some comments about this movement, and Brother Truelove, as pretty much expected, posted a video reply. And what I wanted to do today was to look a little bit at one of the primary points that he made, because again, we accuse each other of talking past each other. I'll let people out there decide. But it just seemed to me that once again, certain things are just simply taken for granted that cannot be taken for granted. And I, again, people go, why do you deal with this? Because I am very concerned when Reformed people abandon the heritage that has been given to us in the advancement in the state of our knowledge of the text since the period of the Reformation. When I read the King James translators, I am absolutely certain they would not have done that. They would not have done that. But that's what I see this movement as a retreat, not an advancement. And hence, I believe that it cripples doing solid, meaningful apologetics, which, and from my perspective, the people who can do the most meaningful apologetics are Reformed people. That's why I'm Reformed. That's why in a couple of weeks when I speak in Wittenberg, my topic of my paper will be similar to what I did at G3, but a little bit more in depth, and specifically on the subject of the Reformed understanding of the atonement as the most effective response to Roman Catholic apologetics on the subject of the Mass and the Eucharistic sacrifice. Well, as I, you know, let's take that subject, for example. As I think on that particular subject, I can't really off the top of my head think of a specific textual variant that would impact that particular subject. I mean, in regards to Roman Catholicism, certainly Romans 5:1 is relevant, even though even Rome doesn't promote the textual variant there. There just aren't that many textual variants that would impact the key topics, because textual, like I said, textual variation doesn't change the theology of the New Testament. But insisting upon a particular English translation based upon a traditional Greek text, problematic from my perspective. So anyway, we were directed to, by Brother Truelove, to the work, the great work of Francis Turretin, his Institutes of Atlantic Theology, three volumes in this form. I do have it in Logos, so I could have pulled these up, but thought I'd use the old paper version for this. And Brother Truelove read some quotes from Turretin that made me go, really? And it's funny, he even said in the video, he said, nah, I'm not gonna argue about the textual stuff about these particular texts. I'm just pointing out. Like, well, that's the problem. You have to. You can run from it. You can hide from it. But we're talking about the text here. We're talking about what the manuscripts say. And one side has the evidence, and the other side just doesn't. Sorry, but you don't. So, to what am I referring? Well, first of all, referring to the need for glasses, I started looking at, this is, for those of you who have Institutes for Linguistic Theology, this is in the first, this is second topic, questions 10, 11 primarily. So that's what you want to be looking at if you want to look at these. And so I was looking through the questions that are given here, and I found it rather fascinating because I don't care where you read in Turretin, the man was just brilliant. And one of the things I think we can learn from our topic today is to once again challenge the sad misapprehension of many regarding church history. That if you disagree with someone on something, if you say they were wrong factually on something, they held a wrong position, then you are either being disrespectful to them or you have to reject everything they said. And, you know, a lot of people just really struggle when I last week pointed people to watch first the BBC version, Martin Luther Heretic, right at an hour long. It's available on YouTube. And then, and only then, watch The Radicals, which is also available on YouTube. And if you watch those two films, you're going to be conflicted. You're going to be conflicted because of the fact that the one presents Luther standing before the powers of his day, seeking to do what was right before God and risking his life to do so, in a matter of years, being willing to use that very same power of government against other people who disagreed with him on very similar issues. This is the issue of sacralism. Really important issue. It's an important issue today. It's an issue that theonomists have to talk about and think about. And so the point being, I can tell people that I have tremendous respect for Calvin and that I read Calvin's Bible commentaries all the time and that they're extremely useful. And you know, the Institutes of the Christian Religion is just monument in Christian history to clarity of thought and expression and depth and all that kind of stuff. And at the same time, recognize he would have minimally had me banished from Geneva. No question about it. And Zwingli, I might have gotten my third baptism from Zwingli, which means being drowned from the bridge there in Zurich. So for a lot of folks, you can't put those two things together. If you can't, you will not be able to study church history. And you will not be able to deal with the reality of the history of what God has done amongst his people and the fact that we live in a fallen world. So I can deeply appreciate Turretin and go, wrong. And as I look at this discussion, I'm gonna let you in on a little secret here, but we have to keep it amongst ourselves, okay? So we have a special filter right now. We're gonna put on the feed, and only truly reformed people are gonna be able to hear what I say, and everybody else will actually only hear me speaking in Klingon. It's a cool filter, and of course I helped to design it because that's why it uses Klingon. Who else would have thought of that? here's the inside story. Why did you go to the wide shot there? Are you making it dark now? What? Oh, you installed the filter. Oh, okay, all right. but it would help if we were closer because I'm trying to whisper to people. So you need to turn the lights back on. Here's the scoop. I think if we're honest with ourselves, some of our Reformed forefathers might have been wrong about a few things. And part of the reason why some of them might have been wrong about a few things is because they overreacted to the people that they were arguing with. Now Rich is using this as an opportunity to play with toys. Okay? And he's completely ruining the whole point of what I was trying to do here, actually. He's just having fun playing with things in the other room. That having passed by, little face palm there, I think that some of our forefathers might have overreacted to Roman Catholicism. It's understandable. In fact, if you study church history at all, if you go back and you read some of the early church fathers, if you read, for example, Irenaeus was arguing against what? Well, and against heresies, he was arguing against Gnosticism. Sometimes you read his arguments and you just go, really? I mean, like there's that one argument that he comes up with where he says it's apostolic tradition that Jesus was more than 50 when he died as an argument against Gnosticism. And we all go, yeah, that didn't come from the apostles. That's the earliest form. That's the earliest reference, by the way, to apostolic tradition in patristic writings. And it's something no one believes actually went back to the apostles, which I always find extremely useful to point out. But Irenaeus overreacted to Gnostics. And some of our Reformed forefathers overreacted to Rome. And I'm going to get in a lot of trouble. I'm going to get a lot of trouble here. But there were some Reformed Baptists back in the 1600s that overreacted to the Presbyterians. I'm done. He's out of there, never going to speak at a Reformed Baptist church again. Yeah, I think that happened. Because all of us, and actually this is nothing new, because any one of you, I remember I first gave my talk on Augustine and the influence of the Donatist and Pelagian controversies on Augustine and his exegesis in the 1990s. So I've been talking about this for at least 20 years. But we are all the product of the conflicts that we engage in. And the reality is that when you're playing tug of war, there's no balance in tug of war. Okay? That's why when someone lets go of the rope, you all end up, that's actually something you might try doing. Everybody else on the other side falls down. If you grab the rope fast enough, you can win. See, that's one of the tricks that you would use. It only generally works once. But anyway, because you're not balanced. And so everybody ends up with imbalances. And I think I've got one certain thing in mind amongst Reformed Baptists. Seems like they just were out of balance in responding to Presbyterians. I think New Covenant theology, for many people, is an imbalanced response to Presbyterianism. And by the way, Presbyterians did the same thing in reverse. Not so much because they actually knew what Baptists believed, but because they just refused to listen to what we believe in the first place. That's another issue. Anyway, so I think some of the Reformation writers, after, especially getting into the 17th century, once the Jesuits really started growing and establishing schools and the Counter-Reformation's in full swing, what did they do? They attacked the scriptures. Now, the funny thing is, the approach of their attack in the 17th century has been abandoned by Rome today. They've just given up on it. The fact that Rome uses the same Greek text that all the rest of us use, well, other than ecclesiastical textbooks, demonstrates they Vulgate, not so much for Sixtus and all that stuff. They gave up on it. That didn't work. But Turretin's writing in the middle of this time period. He's writing when the papists, as he likes to say, are attacking the Reform's ability to use Scripture on the basis of uncertainty about the text itself, as if Rome could give you certainty about the text. Rome couldn't give you certainty about the text. But that was the point of attack. And I think some of the things we're going to look at here illustrate that imbalance on Turretin's part. And it's an imbalance that is fully understandable historically speaking, but is no longer relevant. And we have to go, he was wrong about that. And here's why. Now, if we just refuse to utilize the huge amount of data that is now available to us over 5,800 portions of the New Testament in Greek, cataloged and available now. We just talked last week about two new small but important fragments, Papyri 132 and Papyrus 132 and 133. I guess it'd be papyri if I just put 132 and 133. Anyway, that's a, you know, do we say these things are irrelevant? Do we just ignore them? Can't. So I was looking through, and on it's page 111 of the printed edition. Like I said, this is question 10, number 21. Here's what Turretin writes. There is no corruption in the Greek text of 1 Corinthians 15:47, but only in the Vulgate. The latter omits the word kurios, which here refers to Christ, to make it evident that the Lord is Jehovah, not a mere man. Thus, the antithesis of the first and second Adam becomes much stronger. The first man is of the earth, earthy. The second man is the Lord from heaven. And so, naturally, I go, all right, let's take a look at that and see if that's the case. And so I believe I am sending over to you accordance at 1 Corinthians 15:47. You got that? All right. Now, here is the textual variant right there. If you see that little mark right there, it is indicating the next word. Here you have ha deuteros anthropos ex urnu. So the first man from the earth of the dust, of the earth, earthly. The second man from heaven. And so Turretin said that there's no corruption of the Greek text, that it's kurios. No one's going to be able to see that. We have to keep that up for now. There we go. That it is, and he would have had this reading right here, anthropos hakurios. And why do I say that? Because of this right here. This is the majority text symbol, and that means that it's anthropos hakurios, the second man, the Lord, from heaven, in the corrected hand of Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Alexandrinus, the first correction of Beza Canterbrigensis, KLP, Psi, these including, it's interestingly enough, the marginal reading of 1739 and the main reading of 1881. It is the majority text reading and in the Syriac. P46 stands alone, interestingly enough, P46 being the earliest collection we have of Paul's writings, as anthropos pneumatikos, so spiritual man, probably harkening back to verse 46 and so on and so forth, so that's interesting. Only hakurios is read by 630 and at least what we know of Marcion. And then the text, which is just Anthropos without Hakurios, is the original Sinaiticus, which, of course, had not been discovered in the days of Turretin. But B was known. C, the original reading of D, F, G, 1175, the original 1739. And there's where you have the Latin texts, so it's a Western reading, and the Boharic here. Now, it's interesting that I point to B here, Codex Vaticanus, because of the fact that it was known, and as far back as the early 1520s, Erasmus had written to his friend Bombastius in Rome to actually look at Codex B at 1 John 5:7, which we're going to talk about here a little bit later on. So, given how thorough Turretin is and other things, it's not like he could go to the library and look up the readings of B. And maybe things were such that he didn't have any friends in Rome, as Erasmus did. Remember, Erasmus was a Roman Catholic priest. So, but he did obviously just didn't have access to these things. So what you have here then is you have the two earliest codices outside of the papyri, because here's your one papyrus, and it has Anthropos Pneumaticos. So you have the two earliest both having simply Anthropos as their reading. So you can go ahead and minimize that now. So when you read the statement that there is no corruption in the Greek text of 1 Corinthians 15:47, what do you do now when the facts become the facts? When you can put that on the screen and go, actually, there are a number of Greek manuscripts that do not have that, and they happen to be the earliest Greek manuscripts that do not have that particular reading. You just... Now, I think where people struggle a little bit is the fact that, as he argues, he says, well, hey, this strengthens sound theology. Did you hear what he said? The latter omits the word kurios, which is the Vulgate. Well, the Vulgate here is actually following the earliest Greek witnesses. And almost became a point where, well, the Vulgate's bad and everything else. Again, it's that imbalance that comes from the constant warfare. The latter omits the word kurios, which here refers to Christ, to make it evident that the Lord is Jehovah, not a mere man. Well, didn't I spend a long time talking to Joe Ventilacion about Jesus being Yahweh? Why wouldn't I want all the references I could possibly have to Jesus being Yahweh? I mean, shouldn't we take the reading that could be read in the most orthodox fashion? Don't underestimate the weight of that argument. Do not underestimate the weight of that argument for many people. But the reality is, I want it to be a true argument. I want it to be a consistent argument. If you want to see what happens when you take that kind of reasoning to its final conclusion, watch Joe Ventilacion jumping from translation to translation to translation to come up with whatever is supportive of his position. You can't do that. And you don't get to take your position and determine the reading of Scripture based upon your position. It might be nice to have a reference to Jesus as Jehovah in this text, but if that's not what Paul wrote, then we have no business putting it in there. None. That's why I have said from the beginning The commitment must be, what did the apostles write? If you have anything other than that as your ultimate goal, you're going to have a problem. You're going to have a major problem. And so the fact is, he's just wrong. And so you have to, you know, factually look at that. Okay, now, the section that was specifically read in the video is question 11, paragraph 10. There is no truth in the assertion that the Hebrew edition of the Old Testament and the Greek edition of the New Testament are said to be mutilated, nor can the arguments used by our opponents prove it. Not the history of the adulteress, John 8, 1 through 11. For although it is lacking the Syriac version, it is found in all the Greek manuscripts. That's a factual error. He probably wasn't aware of it, but it's factual error. Not 1 John 5, 7, for although some formerly called it into question and heretics now do, yet all the Greek copies have it. That is not only an error, it's an upside down error. In other words, I don't even know where he got that. I mean, that's not an error, that's a blunder. That's the only way that can be described. As Sixtus Senensis acknowledges, they have been the words of never doubted truth and contained in all the Greek copies from the very time of the apostles. That's laughably untrue. It's just laughably untrue. Not Mark 16, which may have been wanting in several copies in the time of Jerome, as he asserts, but now it occurs in all, even the Syriac version, and is clearly necessary to complete the history of the resurrection of Christ. So, Brother Truelove's point was, well, see, for Turretin, it's the Pericope Adulterae, the Comma Johannium, and the longer ending of Mark. And that's exactly where the ecclesiastical text differs from, well, again, what is the ecclesiastical text? Who knows? It's not the Byzantine text platform. So evidently that's not the ecclesiastical text anymore. Because immediately, again, anyone who uses the Byzantine platform is going to reject what he said about the Comma Johannium. Because it's just false. It is untrue on a factual level. I can give you a list of all of the manuscripts that contain the Comma Johannium. They're all after the 14th century. Most of them have things written in the margin in a 16th, 17th century hand. It is a massively late edition and nothing before the 14th century in a manuscript contains that text. And it's also untrue what is said about the others. It's in all the Greek texts. Here's what we discover when we look at something like this. On the comma, I don't know how Turretin got that far off, but on the other two, I can at least understand how he came to the conclusions that he did. I get it. But what do we do now? What do we do in a day where we have all of this information available to us? Do we just close our eyes to it? Call it some type of modern conspiracy? Or do we have to examine even the people that we have great respect for from the past in the light of the reality that we now face today? I do not believe that it is a Christian, it's a characteristic of sound Christian theology to close your eyes to factual evidence in regards to the claims of the Christian faith, even regards to the claims of the Christian faith in regard to the scriptures themselves. As Dan Wallace has said many times, there are many people who are willing to trade the truth for certainty. There are many people willing to trade the truth for certainty. And this movement away from the text that allows us to rejoice in the catalog, the discovery and cataloging of P-132 and 133, and to look at that information and consider its dating and to take it into consideration in examination of the very few verses, but still the verses that those texts will now be cited in regards to in future editions of the Greek New Testament. That's a good thing. That's a proper thing. That's an appropriate thing. It's being accepting of the great gifts that God has given us in being able to give an answer to those who question the validity of the transmission of the text of the New Testament. Ignoring those things or saying that those things, you know, I hear people say, well, you know, if God wanted us to have that stuff, then we would have had it all along. Especially someone who calls themselves an ecclesiastical text advocate. I'm sorry, but it seems like some of these people have the view that the church has only existed since the Reformation. Because I can go back to these early manuscripts. Weren't they a part of the church? It's almost unfortunate because of the name, the Codex Vaticanus, is called Codex Vaticanus. But obviously, it was far earlier than the Vatican. And there's something I want to point out. I've got a little whiteboard program here. We'll use a little whiteboard program. Codex Vaticanus is called Codex. Wow. Why isn't tip size, color, tip size? Okay, it's called Codex B. Now, we have another manuscript, which is earlier. Now, we date B to between 325 and 350. We have another manuscript, an important papyri manuscript, called P 75. All right? It's a Gospels manuscript with Luke and John. And it's around 175. So it's about 150 years earlier than B. When you collate their readings, there are times when these two manuscripts stand alone in having readings found no place else. So what we've discovered is B is a copy of an earlier manuscript that's in the same line as P75, right up here. B is not a copy of P75, but B and P75 are both in the same line coming down from this earlier manuscript. If this is 175, this is 325, then this is at least 150, maybe earlier. So it goes way, 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 way back into the history of the New Testament, at least in the Gospels. You know, in all likelihood, the rest of B has the same antiquity to it, but we have to be careful that, you know, this can only prove it as far as the Gospels are concerned. So the point is that today we can, without apology, look to our Muslim friends and say, well, actually, we can trace our text in the Gospels back to the same contemporaneous time period as that little fragment, P52. And in case some of you just gotten completely lost this point or completely bored this point, one of the things that's relevant about this did come up in the INC debate. And what am I referring to? I'm referring to the reading in John chapter 1, verse 18. Because John 1:18, the use of theos there, is found in both Aleph and B, and both P66 and P75, which are our two earliest, not including P52, because it's only a fragment of a couple of verses, but our two earliest manuscripts, almost complete manuscripts, of the Gospel of John. And so what that means is, it, when you have B and P75 agreeing on a reading, that is an absolutely ancient reading. When you throw in a second papyrus, P66, which is contemporaneous P75, and you throw in Sinaiticus, this is another reason why the Sinaiticus is a fraud stuff is just so absurd. Because Sinaiticus contains readings that are plainly traceable back to the papyri, which hadn't been discovered in the days of Simonides. So much for all that blather from the King James only folks. Anyway, that reading that came up briefly in the debate is found in P66, P75, Sinaiticus, and B. Which means it is, without a question, traceable to within 25 to 30 years of the composition of the Gospel of John in the first place. So at the very, 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 very least, it has to be taken into consideration in your examination of what John is actually saying. And it fits perfectly in the functioning as the bookends to the prologue of John, the theology of which we talked about on the last program. So what's our conclusion here? This is a tremendous reality that once you understand it can greatly increase your confidence in the text of the New Testament. But how's it relevant to an ecclesiastical text person? You see, from my perspective, it's extremely relevant to the church because this was the text of the early church. That's still the church. Bringing something in from, well, in this case, talking about what the text of the church, what, approximately 1,500 years later was? Well, they used it when we wrote these great confessions of faith 1,500 years later. Well, that's wonderful. But if you can't see the danger of saying, and therefore we should read this because it was used at the Westminster Assembly or it was used by the framers of the London Baptist Confession or something, if you can't see that that's not how to deal with New Testament textual issues, that's sort of scary. We've been given tremendous material to use in our day, right when we need it, to defend the veracity of the text of the New Testament. Going backwards accomplishes absolutely, positively nothing. So, some things to think upon, my friends, as we consider these important issues. No more programs for this week. Lord willing, we will have a fairly full schedule next week because it's a week from Saturday that I head to Europe. I've got the debate in London on the 15th. Your prayers for that very much appreciated. We still need your support for all the traveling. Going to be gone for 22 days. That's the longest I've ever been away. But prayers for health during all that time, all the teaching I'm going to be doing. And then we've got more travel coming up right after that. So your support is very much needed and appreciated. Thanks for listening to the program today. We'll see you next time. God bless.